find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at KaleidoScience, Conversations on Cognitive Science.
Even though there are many helpful tools already around for blind people, some everyday situations can still be very difficult. It is, for example, quite difficult to navigate a supermarket using a white cane. Today we have the pleasure to talk to Marcin Futak, who is a PhD student at the University of Osnabrück, and who is writing his PhD thesis in collaboration with FeelSpace, and who is helping to develop tools to help blind people better navigate everyday life.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Happy to be here.
And as always, we play our short get-to-know game, where I give you 5 sentences and ask you to finish them as spontaneously as you can.
All right.
So the first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be
a football player. That's an easy one. So I really, yeah.
Do you mean American football or soccer?
No. Soccer. So okay. I wanted to play for Real Madrid or Barcelona, but as you can see, I didn't really fulfill that dream, but I'm living other dream now, so I'm happy with the development.
If I was an emoji, I would be?
A laughing one, perhaps, but not with, like, laughing with tears, just laughing with a big smile on the face.
With eyes opened or those triangle eyes?
Yeah, I think I would go with eyes open. I'm a classic guy. So when I had my first phones, we didn't have so many emojis. So
it was just double dot and then D.
Yeah, exactly. OG times. Classic.
I think Sophie was just hinting at also noses with a minus. Okay, the third sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is?
To relax, to spend some time in the nature, to read books, to do some sports, to travel. So lots of options. I don't have one specific variant of spending free time, but I really enjoy my free time. So I can really deal with my free time in various ways.
Are you reading scientific books in your free time or leisure time, or are you reading fictional things?
So I'm not a picky reader. I'm reading everything. Right now I'm reading a book by Garry Kasparov where he discusses development of AI in chess. And it's pretty funny because the book is from, I think, 8 years ago, and he's, for example, saying that AlphaZero won't be such a good chess player for many years. 2 years later, AlphaZero became the best chess bot in the world. So he kind of missed his prediction there. But I also read the fiction books. I read documentaries. And I try to read in both Polish and English. So try to intertwine that.
Nice. The next sentence. Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
Oh, I think my project is something that fascinates me the most right now. So the question, what are the limits of human capacity to process tactile signals? How can we aid humans in their everyday life by using this modality, which is not really that frequently used? But there are lots of other topics that I really enjoy as well. But at this stage, I think this one is the best and most fascinating one for me.
Uh-huh. And the last sentence. I know it's time to call it a day when?
When I can't focus anymore. So when I feel that I'm just sitting mindlessly, I don't really do any work done, and I just look at my watch or check the time and try to reach some imaginary deadline, I think it's just better to end it for the day 30 minutes earlier than I'm supposed to, than to just sit and pretend that I'm doing some work.
Yeah, I think it's like that for most people we are talking to. It's a quite frequent answer. So thank you very much. And right now you're doing a PhD with FieldSpace at the University of Osnabrück, but like you did not study in Osnabrück. You mentioned that you are reading Polish books, so you have a Polish background. Where did you study at the beginning? What was your bachelor's? What was your master's? How did you end up here?
Okay, so that's quite a bumpy road, I would say. So I first studied automation and robotics in Warsaw, Poland. It wasn't my dream degree. I didn't really know what to study after my high school. So I picked this one because I really liked that there are a plethora of options where I could specialize afterwards. And there were also some friends who were going to that degree. So it's like lots of pragmatic reasons, but not really any deep fascination with anything. The only factor that was really interesting for me was developments of AI that I knew are related to that topic, but I didn't really know that much about that stuff back then. During this bachelor, I also started Bachelor in Cognitive Science in Warsaw at University of Warsaw, and I finished both of these bachelors successfully. After that, I studied my master's in Pavia in Italy, psychology, neuroscience, and human sciences. Unfortunately, it was during the COVID time, so most of the studies were remote. And then after my master's, for a while, I left academia. I worked as a data engineer, data scientist. And after some time, I realized I really miss it and I really want to continue my career as a scientific researcher. So I decided to pursue a PhD, started looking for one, and a project in Osnabrück was the one that was most appealing to me, and it was also the first one that responded to me. So it was like basically I got some hints from the universe that this is a way for me. The interview process went smoothly, and I started last June, so I'm for more than a year now here in Osnabrück, and I absolutely love it so far.
Maybe for our listeners, we've had an episode with Susanne Wache in our last season, who is one of the founders of FieldSpace. She was working on a navigation belt, but you are not working on a navigation belt now. So what are you working on?
So I am working on a conceptual extension of the navigation belt. So we are developing a tactile bracelet, which is supposed to help blind people grasp. So imagine that you don't have a vision and you want to grasp a mug with coffee or tea that you have next to you. If you leave this mug somewhere around you and you focus on some other task, then you want to grab the mug again, you might have some problems with that, because most of blind people are quite good in dealing with their environment, considering that they have a lack of vision, but there are lots of everyday simple tasks that they struggle with and that they would really could use some assistance with. Grasping is one of them. So we talked with some blind participants. They told us that everyday scenario like that would really, it would be really useful for them to have some assistive device that could help them deal with such scenario. So our concept is to have a bracelet which is connected to the camera. Underneath there will be some AI stuff happening, processing of the visual feedback from the camera, and it will be translated to the tactile signals, which are then sent to the bracelet. So basically, you can imagine that you have a bracelet on your wrist, and you tell the system that you want to now grasp a banana or a mug or an apple, and when you look around with the camera, which right now is attached to the helmet, but in the final version, it will be, we plan to use smartphones because almost everyone has a smartphone now. And we plan to have an app that utilizes the smartphone camera. So you can in one hand hold your camera with your phone and use the other hand for grasping. So the system is supposed to detect the objects. It's supposed to detect hand position, and it is supposed to translate all of this information to a tactile stimuli sent to the bracelet in a way that if you are supposed to move your hand to the left side, then the left vibromotor on the wrist is supposed to vibrate. And upon reaching the position to grasp the object, you will receive other type of signal, which is specific for grasping.
For me, it's a little bit difficult right now to imagine like how that practically would look like. So if a person wants to grab the mug, which is standing kind of next to them, they're wearing the bracelet, they're having the smartphone in the other hand, how do they tell the smartphone that they want to find their coffee mug, and what happens like in between until they have it in their hand?
Okay, so maybe I will take a step back and go through the development of this project so far. So we have one publication in Sensors where we first compared, it was actually data was collected before I joined the project. So big shout outs to Piper Powell, Milat Rugari, and...
Sorry, we also had a short interview with Piper already. So Sophie and I actually also already talked to Piper in December, in our December episodes. So if our listeners want to listen to the beginning of this whole project, and they can also do that, but thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. So, exactly. I really like that episode as well. So I recommend it. So big shout out to Piper, to Milat Rugari, and to Florian Petzold, who were the, people who were pushing the project forward before I joined. The data that they collected was from the experiment where they tried to compare how tactile signals are working in comparison to the auditory signals. So there are lots of assistive devices for blind people, but most of them utilize auditory signals. So you can have some apps or some other type of device. There is, for example, glasses where you can take a picture and they translate what is happening around you to some easily understandable signals. So they can tell you, for example, in front of you, there are three people and a table. These solutions work really nicely, but they have one major problem. They are auditory, so they take up the source of most of the information that blind people use. As they lack vision, auditory signals are the most important source of information about their environment. So using such devices have a big advantage that they can deal with some tasks, but on the other hand, they also lose a lot of data about their surroundings. So our rationale is behind usage of tactile signals exactly that. We want to limit the use of auditory signals and try to utilize tactile capacity of humans, which is not commonly used. Like in everyday life, we don't really use that many tactile signals for navigation or for simple tasks. We maybe, for example, our smartphones may vibrate if someone is calling and we can feel that. So this is a simple example of how vibration can help us. Other from that, we don't really use haptic signals. And there are lots of devices which use haptics right now being developed. So we are using vibrations as this is, as I said, conceptual extension of the tactile belt, which also used vibromotors. There are also some examples of devices which use other variants of haptic signals. So they use, for example, thermal signals, because we can also detect some whether our environment is hot or cold. There are some devices which use pressure signals, but this is for another story. Let's say in our project we use vibromotors, and we try to utilize them to assist blind people. And as I said in the previous study that was conducted before my arrival at the project, the idea was to try to compare how these tactile signals fare in comparison to auditory signals. So there was a task where people were supposed to grasp some objects on the shelves, and they were guided by the experimenter remotely, either by auditory signals. So the experimenter could say, Now move your hand left, 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 up, 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 and now grasp. So this is kind of signals that we are kind of used in everyday life, maybe not in such a scenario, but we are quite good in distinguishing and using auditory inputs. And in the second condition, the participants wore the tactile bracelet and they were guided remotely by the experimenter who were sending tactile signals. So in the same exact example, there was vibration to the left side, then to the up, and then there was signal for grasping. And the goal was to see whether people are even able to distinguish these signals and whether performance is similar to auditory signals. The results show that people are very good at it, even without a lot of training, and that they were slower for tactile condition than for auditory condition. But it was expected, as we are not so used to tactile signals. But interestingly and importantly, the learning effect was very steep for both conditions. So it shows that people were able to learn the task and they didn't have to focus that much on learning the tactile signals themselves. So people can get this bracelet and from the get-go, they can be quite good in distinguishing and using those tactile signals. Potentially, if they have more training, they will be even better. This is something that we also want and aim to investigate later in this project. But the initial results were very encouraging and showing us that this is a venue that is worth pursuing further. So now we are working on automating this solution. So as I mentioned, in the previous experiment, experimenter was either sending auditory or tactile signals. Now we want to remove the experimenter from the system, and we want to put the AI controller in there. So basically, we don't want people to have a need for someone standing next to them, looking through the camera or above their shoulder and navigating them, because it's not feasible setup for our real lives. We rather want to have automated solution. And we actually already developed that. So we have a system where we have two object detectors. One is for detecting target objects and the other one is for detecting hands. It distinguishes between my hands and your hands. So it's quite essential if you think about this scenario of grasping. We need to be able to see whether hand in the field of view of the camera is our hand or hand of some other person, because if we use some other people's hands for navigation, then it's gonna end up messy. And we also, Florian, who is doing his master thesis on this project, is developing the depth estimators, actually like using different depth estimators and implemented some code that enables us to see how far these objects are without using any type of sensor, just single camera frames. So we also want to utilize this depth signal, because in the final version, we would like this system to be smooth, effortless, and working in 3D. So we would like people to be able to not move automatically, robotically, but rather for them to move in a smooth manner. So they would resemble, that their movements would resemble movements of regular people just grasping in a real life scenario.
That was really a lot. Like, just to wrap it up shortly and repeat again what you've just explained, because I think it was a lot of information. So at the beginning, in the first experiments, you had an experimenter telling the bracelet where to vibrate, and now you're working on a more automated solution where you use a camera. I think right now you mentioned it's a helmet, but you're planning to have mobile phone camera. And right now you're also working on how to get in-depth vision for the camera. Why is that relevant? Like, why is it relevant to know how deep space is, and why is that tricky as well?
Well, so you can imagine a scenario where you are trying to grasp an apple and the systems that we have for the object detection, they don't really provide us with any information about the distance from the target object. So we may have a scenario where we tell the system, okay, we want to grasp an apple, the apple is detected, but it's unfortunately 10 meters away. And then we will have a case where we are guided, our hand is guided to this apple, but we will unfortunately obviously fail, because unless we are Michael Jordan in the Space Jam and we can like have our arms elongated, then we won't be able to grasp this object because it's too far. So we need this depth information for this exact reason, because in the right now we develop our system mainly in the lab, but we want it to be usable in the real world environment. So one case is supermarket that was mentioned before, but also just in the home environments, it would also be really useful for people, as I said, with these examples of leaving the mug somewhere and then looking for it later, or leaving the keys to the doors where you can forget where exactly they were and you have to spend a lot of time searching for them if you're a blind person. Our system could really easily solve that. But for it to be able to move outside of the lab, we really need this depth depth estimator to be working properly. Potentially, we also need to develop the hardware of the bracelet. So at this stage, we have four vibromotors on the left, right, up and down of the wrist. There is another master student, Felicia, who is working on developing new setup of the bracelet, which is more like a arm sleeve where the motors are put in a different positions, because if there are several vibromotors on the wrist, people might have difficulties in distinguishing between the signals. Our spatial capacities at the wrist are not the best, let's say. For example, with Navi belt, which is put on the belly of the participants, we are way better in distinguishing between these signals. If I remember correctly, belt has 16 vibromotors, and there were also testing variants with more of motors. For our case, we are limited first by the size of the wrist. It's difficult to put so many vibromotors, but then also by detectability of the signal, because we can put 20 vibromotors on the wrist, but people won't be able, people sometimes are not able to distinguish between four vibromotors. Sometimes the signal from the right, if you're right-handed, you can take a look at your hand. There is a bone on the right side, which is really reducing sensitivity. So usually people are confusing signals on the top and to the right. So Felicia, who is, as I mentioned, working on creating new setup of the bracelet, she's trying to move some vibromotors along the arm, so people will be able to distinguish between vibrations more easily. And we have also some other ideas how to develop our system further. The more vibromotors, in a way, the better, because we can send more signals and potentially people will be able to distinguish between these signals more easily. On the other hand, it also increases the required resources that people have to use to process these signals. So this is also for future work, how many vibromotors in which location we could use for people to be able to use them properly.
I think like it makes a lot of sense, and it makes it like easier for me to understand, like looking at how you develop the bracelet. But I would still like to come back to my original question, namely, like, how do the participants tell the app what they want? And then you explain how they're guided there. But how do the participants tell the app what they want in the first place? How do they communicate that?
Sure. Sorry for digressing to lots of other topics. So right now we are providing inputs via the experimenter's laptop. It's not mobile at this stage of the project, so everything is connected and run from the laptop, not from the smartphone. So we just provide input in via the console or via list in Python. So we have strings which determine the labels of the object that we are able to distinguish. But at later stages, we want to use auditory commands. So we envision people just saying, okay, I want to now in a supermarket, let's say, I want to shop for apples, I want to shop for carrots, and I want to shop for milk. And we want this system to be able to save these specific target objects and then guide people whenever they see one of these. So probably we have some ideas how we can do that. There was also another study project which was actually doing initial version of the app, and they had this module for auditory to string conversion. It's not really that difficult to implement, right? At this stage, we don't really need that. That's why we don't use it. But later, we want to use it like that. But basically, we want this to be sort of a tactile mobile assistant for people connected to smartphone. They will have to use some auditory commands, but this will be them speaking and not receiving auditory signals. The rest should be done by tactile signals.
Okay, and then after the people have told the bracelet what they want, the bracelet starts guiding them. And you already pointed out that it has four motors, but for somebody who has never seen the Feel Space belt or anything whatsoever, how do these motors look like?
Okay, so they are quite tiny. They are placed on a small strap, which is which you can put on your wrist. And I think their size is, there are, good question. Because they are not coin motors, they are small, how to describe it? Like, first of all, maybe if you have the wrist on, you don't see those motors. So they are put like on the inside of the bracelet to have a maximum effect on your wrist. So you just see the bracelet itself. The motors themselves are quite tiny and they are just elongated tubes. They diameter is several millimeters. So you don't really see them or feel them that much unless they are vibrating. If you have the bracelet on and it's the proper size for your wrist, you shouldn't really feel any strong pressure to the skin. The motors are exactly the same kinds of motors that were used in the Navi belt. So, but there is also another study project group. There are lots of study project groups here. Which is working on adding more motors, because as I mentioned, four motors work just fine for some cases of navigation. But if we could have more motors, for example, four motors are really useful for navigation in 2D. So if you just want to move your hand in 2D space like that, and then you are happy with receiving a grasping signal once reaching the position where you are in front of the object, then the system already does that. And we can also run multiple motors at the same time. So we can send not only signals to the left or to the up, but we can also send the signal on the diagonal. And we can send different vibrations of different intensities. So we can basically cover the whole 360 plane in 2D. And then once we reach the target object, we send the grasping signal and people are supposed to move their hand forward.
And the grasping signal is probably some kind of special vibration or something. So the participant knows, okay, no navigation is done. Now we are here where we want to be.
Yeah, exactly. So for grasping, we just vibrate all of the motors in a like pulsating manner. So you can clearly distinguish that now you reach the target and you're just supposed to move forward. And we have, like, this is basically everything we can do with this setup. And as I said, in the future, we would like to move to 3D. We don't want to only cover this 2D plane and have these robotic movements and then moving forward. Already moving on the diagonals, it enables us to have quite a smooth movement first into the end and then forward. But ideally, we would like to have the 3D trajectory from the beginning. So we wouldn't want to first align in 2D and then grasp, but rather to move in all directions at the same time. So moving in the depth direction and also in 2D direction. So like in a natural manner. Problem with our setup right now is that we just don't have enough possibility to send information. Because if you want to send information about depth, we can't do that if we change the representation of the signal somehow. So we may have, for example, intensity of vibration as the information about how far the object is from us. But then we lose some of the capacity in the 2D plane, because now we use this vibration intensity for some other type of information. We cover this 360 plane by changing vibration intensity, so we can say how far the object is. If we translate that to depth, then we can use depth, but we also have more funkiness in this 2D plane. So basically, we just don't have enough vibromotors. There is study project group which is working exactly on that, so they try to come up with a setup where they could add two more vibromotors, ideally. One would be for forward and one for the backward movement. And it would solve everything for such a 3D problem, because then if we can just vibrate all the time forward or backward vibromotor independently of the 2D navigation. So in a sense, we can navigate in 2D while at the same time sending signal, okay, now move to the left and top, but also move forward. And in a way, we can create this smooth trajectories in 3D.
That's really cool. And so for seeing the surroundings, you currently have a helmet, which includes the camera. So that means that people basically have a look around them, and then the helmet communicates with a bracelet. Is it connected with a wire? Like, how does it work?
So right now we have the helmet, bike helmet with the camera connected on top of that. It's connected to the laptop, which is like a controlling device at this stage. And the bracelet is also connected to the laptop. It can be connected wirelessly or via Bluetooth. Camera is always connected with wire. And yeah, the feedback, the signal from the camera goes to the program that we have written, controlling program in Python, which, as I said, sends these signals to object detectors, which are supposed to distinguish what is happening in the scene. So they are supposed to check what kind of objects are in the scene, whether any of those objects is a target object. It's supposed to see whether the hand is in the scene, because there's also a possibility that someone sees their surroundings, but they don't really put their hand in front of the camera. So in such scenario, it's impossible to navigate towards the target. We also have some other control signals for providing participants with this information. So for example, if the target object is seen, but there is no hand in front of the camera, we send some pulsating signal on the vibromotor on the top or down. But one more important thing about the navigation itself. So for the navigation, the signal is continuous. So we always vibrate the motor if we are navigated. Thus, when the vibrations are pulsating, it also provides people with some information. So for example, if the target object is lost and we can only see the hand, we can send different pulsation on a different vibromotor. When the target object is visible, but the hand is not there, we can send other type of pulse to tell people, okay, you have the target in front of you, but you now need to add your hand to the screen, because otherwise we can't navigate.
Did you already do trials on participants who were blind, like blind from birth or blinded later in life? Because I remember that the space belt makes a difference for people, or makes a difference for people who are able to see, for people who are were never able to see, and for people who got blind later in life.
Yeah, so Well, study projects group will be the theme of this one, but there was another study project group which collected data with blind participants throughout the Germany. So they used the setup that we had for our paper with minor variations, but it was basically the same paradigm. They collected the data throughout the Germany. The problem with blind participants, by the way, is that it's very difficult to find those people and to... Like, if you think, how would you recruit blind participants? Lots of blind people don't really do that much stuff in their lives, in a sense that they need assistance for navigation in the world. They are not very active. This is a big problem that we would like to help them with as well. But basically, our study project group was traveling around Germany and across multiple conferences, events, and they gathered data from, I think, around 50 blind people. And the preliminary results that they got was that the same pattern holds. So they were slower in the tactile condition, but they were also able to effortlessly detect those signals, and they were getting better quite quickly. Potentially with more training, they would be even better. There is no manuscript from that research yet, but we are planning on publishing that in the upcoming months. But importantly, outside of the objective measures, so how they managed to like detect the signals and what were their reaction times, it's important to look at how they feel about it, because we might have our idea what they would like to use or what would be useful for them, but if in real life it's only our like pipe dream and they wouldn't really want it, then it wouldn't make sense to develop this solution. And we had two blind participants ourselves, and then the study project group had lots of blind participants, and they said that they really like this setup. They think that it might be useful for them and that they think it's quite comfortable. So obviously there's lots of stuff to polish there, but it's really encouraging because it shows that the whole principle is really good and it might be usable for them in real life.
I remember that from in the interview with Susanne, she mentioned that some blind people had first time a sensation of space. So did you get any feedback from your participants, or did you collect any feedback on in how far that changed their perception? Because I would imagine that for depth sensation, even if you were never able to see, you kind of know how space directly around you works. But mm-hmm. I could also be super mistaken here, because I also did not expect that blind people could not imagine the concept of a room as Susanne described it to us. So like people understood for the first time what it means to be in a room by wearing the belt. While I would assume there are slightly different effects for bracelet wear, which simply only helps you to grasp things. So do you have any feedback on that?
Sure. So first of all, I think the bracelet is in the early stages of its development. The project itself is running for 2.5 years. So compared to belt, it's still baby steps. I also think that the bracelet is more task focused. So the belt, the idea behind the research of the belt, from what I understood first, was to check whether this new sense might develop if we use the compass signal always guiding us to the north. It's also used for wayfinding now, but the initial principle was to use the belt at all times. So basically you should have it on throughout the day, and it provides you with this additional sensory information at all times. I think the bracelets will be different in a sense that we will use it only for a specific task. So we don't really expect people to have the bracelet on all the time. We rather expect them to wear it or run it only if they want to grasp something. So it's also like a big distinction between sensory augmentation devices and assistive devices, which are of more general use, and assistive devices which are of more specific use. So I think our bracelet is a device of a second type. So it's really difficult for me to predict whether people might have developments in some like general ability to detect the depth. I think they might for sure get better in being able to distinguish signals and navigate the space with their hand, but whether it will have some larger general effects on their ability to process their environment, I'm really curious to test that, but I don't really have any predictions, to be honest.
Because I just thought, because for me, when I stretch my arm in front of me, I see where it ends. Like, my eyes can see where it ends and how far away my arm is. But if you can't see it, you can only feel if your arm is stretched or not. And when you have a bracelet that stops vibrating at a certain point, you might also get different perception of your own body in space. But yeah, as you mentioned, it will show at some point, quite likely.
Yeah, that's true. But also, in a sense, you have a perception of your hand and your arm in a space in relation to the target object, because we don't use the bracelets independently of the target. So there's always a target. So yeah, but that's really interesting as well, because I think people might get better in being able to like process the distances between them and their target objects and their environment in general. So they might get better in processing the depth component of the surroundings. It's really, really good question.
I think I would like to pick up the topic a little bit again about testing blind people with a bracelet, because you already mentioned that recruitment is kind of difficult because these people are often not very well involved, like in a lot of things. And when I think about participant recruitment, we usually hang up flyers, which is obviously not an option for the blind participants unless somebody like comes across it and tells them about it. How do you contact blind participants?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, because now I realized I didn't add one key detail before. So when we had normally sighted people during our research, they were blindfolded. So when we had this test of auditory versus tactile, and in the future research, we will always blindfold people so they don't have vision, obviously. I didn't say that explicitly, but I think it's really important. So as for recruitment of blind participants, FieldSpace already has quite a large base of contacts, which is really useful because we can use their contact list for trying to reach blind people who might be interested in using such a device and testing this device. Still, it's kind of difficult, and we also don't want to utilize this blind participant pool that we have until we are happy with our solution and we know that it works really well. So, for example, in our previous study, we had 30 healthy subjects, like, in a sense of sight, like normally sighted, and we had two blind participants as sort of a follow-up, where we also focused more about their subjective experience. There was this study project group that I mentioned. It was run only after this experiment was concluded. Now we are working on the automation of the solution, and we're going to follow the same pattern. So we're going to first run with blindfolded people, because it's way easier to find participants who are just willing to get blindfolded and move their hand around and grasp objects than to find blind participants. So at each stage of this project, we're going to likely follow the same protocol of first validating normally sighted people and then trying it out on blind participants, which also has a big caveat, because obviously they process their environments differently and they process space differently. But so far we've received positive feedback both in like objective measures and also subjective measures. So unless we reach a big discrepancy, we're gonna likely follow that setup.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Maybe one question to what is currently most difficult in the development of the bracelet and also the whole setup, because like we've touched on the spatial and in-depth thing, but also like, for example, having really similar objects. So if you have, I don't know, an orange and a clementine, so which look quite similar, but just different in size, for example. Is that an issue? Is that simple? How are experiences so far?
Yeah, so as I said, we have two separate object detectors, one for hand. And with this one, we don't really have any problems. And there is another one for objects. And this one is a topic for larger discussion because we so far use YOLOv5 trained on COCO dataset. So it's like a basically classic dataset for object recognition. And it has some like general labels like apple or banana, but if someone wants red apple specifically, we don't really have possibility or capacity to distinguish that. Also, the amount of labels is quite limited. So if we would like to have more labels, we would have to retrain this network in a way. So far we just try to automate and validate this solution. And then there's a big question how to change these labels, how to make that device more suited to person's specific needs. Because in the end, I would envision that as being part of a trend of like individual health. So we wouldn't want that device to have the set of 50 labels that people have to adjust to, but rather to adjust targets, objects that people can grasp to people's needs. And yeah, this is like big issue of continuous learning and using different sets of labels. We are not really focusing on that right now. We know it's along the way somewhere, but at this stage of the project, we just try to create a setup where we have multiple components that we can easily interchange later. So in a way, we are prepared for this problem to appear in the future, and we might then pursue different solutions easily because we can easily change the object detector. If we want object detector only for apples of different colors, we can train such object detector and use it. So this setup will enable us to do that. Outside of that, I think the biggest problem right now is more technical. So we have a lot of stuff running in our program. As I said, some object detectors, also object tracking algorithm to be sure that we are always grasping the same apple. We don't want to have like asymptotic movements where we lose the apple and then suddenly the target is somewhere else and our hand is guided to multiple different positions. And we also, as I said, plan to use depth estimators. So right now we have, it's possible to run it on our laptop, but we will need to optimize it further if we want to use it on mobile devices, because I think that at this stage, it wouldn't be possible to use smartphone. But here also time is our friend because devices are being, new smartphone generations are being developed every year. So with passing time, we actually are in a better position to move our program from laptop to the mobile applications. So basically we are quite lucky because usually we are running out of time. And in our case, we are quite happy that we still have some time for developments before we have to actually move to the mobile solution.
If the AI is faced, if the bracelet is faced with multiple of the same objects, so if there's like a shelf full of apples, does the AI then make a decision to go for one of them, or does it get confused?
Yeah, so we basically now, right now we use an algorithm which looks for the target object, and if it finds multiple objects of the same category, it fixates on one which had the highest probability. So for people who are not technical at all, our object detector is a model which estimates whether something in the image is an object of a specific class, and it also estimates probability that this object is of such class. So basically we have a model which is able to see the image of an apple and say, okay, I think this is an apple with probability of 95%. So if we have several apples, then we're gonna fixate on the one which is most probable to be an apple, and then we're gonna continue guidance towards that apple unless something breaks along the way. So if someone takes this apple away, then we're gonna change the navigation to the other target. But basically, we are able to deal with multiple objects of the same instance. And this is part of our automated solution. We're going to start collecting data, I think, next month or a month after that. And we have a paradigm where one task is exactly about it. So we want to have multiple objects of the same category and show that system doesn't go crazy when it's multiple objects and it's not able to do anything, or it just moves from one target to another. So right now we have a fixation towards one target, then we go after that to another target if someone's still looking for second apple or third apple. But also it's like a bigger question of the final use cases, because if we have dozens of apples in the supermarket and blind person wants to buy apples, there's also a question of how exactly they operate in their environments and to what exactly what they want. Because if they just want to be guided to apples and then they want to feel those apples and pick the apples that they like the most by their tactile properties, then just going to one apple is enough. But there's also a question of these more specific labels in the future, because right now we can't distinguish between different types of apples or different types of milks or whatever. But potentially we would like people to be able to be guided to different types of apples. So lots of apples in this sense.
I was just grinning at myself the whole time, because when you're always guided to the most probable apple, you're always guided to the ideal prototype apple, banana, whatever. So by default, if you always follow that, blind people would, or people who use that device would always buy the product that's most looking like the prototype and most average apple, banana. And I think it just sounds so funny to me from a, I don't know what exactly perspective, but to me it just sounds so funny to imagine that by kind of by accident, people could always buy the most ideal product.
Yeah, the AI chooses the perfect apple for you.
Yeah, that's future of AI, picking perfect. Yeah, that's, it's slightly more like philosophical approach, but yeah, that's really interesting. But yeah, that's true in a sense. Now, but here, if we go into a little bit of philosophy, the question is about what exactly is this prototype, and whether we can get its properties from the data sets of finite amount of observations. Because for us humans, we are able to easily like come up with concepts of something. The models that we use for object detection, they are trained on hundreds of thousands of images of apples, and then they can create mathematical functions like distinguishing between multiple observations on several planes. So they basically just have some capacity to mathematically distinguish between properties of an image. And the prototype is really dependent then on the data set that we use, because we can have prototypical apple from data set A and from data set B, and they will differ slightly. So
to avoid that not all people are always hunting for the exact same apple, you should give them different data sets in the background.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, they won't compete for the same apple.
In a similar vein still of object recognition. So if you, for example, look at milk. Milk is in a similar carton to juice, for example. And when you want to buy milk and not juice, you probably have to be able to identify the label or the pictures on the milk, for that matter. Can the AI read, basically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we just have object detectors, but there was also some thinking done about how we would solve that in a supermarket environment. So one example is to have what's the name, like the codes on the products, like
the barcodes.
Yeah, barcodes. It's quite easy to scan the barcodes, so you don't even have to use the text reading models. You can just scan the barcode and you can check it up in a data set. There are web-based data sets of the barcodes kept. But also, it's conceptually, it requires some more thinking, because if we want to guide people to the milk and then they have to look for the barcode to see whether it's a proper milk, then it gets really complicated. So I think initially we were thinking about the supermarket setup, but after discussing with blind people and analyzing the cases, I think our solution would be more useful actually in this like home environments and supermarkets. We can deal with lots of stuff there, but at this stage we are more focusing on just like target objects in a not really that crowded environments. In supermarkets we have lots of other distractors and other issues, and also as I said, we discuss with blind participants, because there's also like a question whether we want to have a solution which is developed in a way, in a top-down manner, so we try to force them to use our solution in a specific way, or whether we want to use it bottom-up by like develop it in a bottom-up manner, where we would ask them questions about their behavior and how they use it, and we would try to create a solution which is suited for their needs. And both cases and both approaches have their pros and cons. But I think we are more inclined to have a constant discussions with people, like continuous discussions, because we don't want to end up in a scenario where we like play around in a lab and we get lost in our lab cases and lab scenarios, while real world doesn't work like that. So for example, with these multiple apples that we mentioned, it's something that we were like discussing for a long time and working on that. And then we actually thought, okay, but how blind people buy in shops? Like what's the way they approach supermarkets and how do they look for food and whether they touch stuff to feel how it looks? And I think it's frequently the case. So if they find apples, they actually want to touch those apples to like feel which one they like the most. So in a way, we might be thinking about lots of these solutions for finding milk of a specific brand with, I don't know, specific fat levels. And in the meantime, blind people maybe don't really operate in that way. The question is also whether we should always follow the way they operate, because maybe we can help them and enhance their abilities and assist them in a way they didn't really think about.
I think it's just perfect statement at that point. So it's really difficult to make a follow-up statement.
I think I've also asked everything I've wondered about. So do you still want to, like, do you still have something where you're like, I really want to mention this, or this is really important to be discussed in this context?
Yeah, so I think I would like to say that visually impaired and blind people are really amazing in lots of tasks, and we have a tendency, maybe as a society, to look at people with some impairments as being worse in a way, which I think is not correct at all, because they have some impairments, but it's not that they are absolutely dependent on other people. They are independent in lots of ways. And I think we want to assist them, but I don't feel that, like, they could use some assistance, but it's not that if we don't help them, then they're gonna just, I don't know, end up by themselves in a corner crying or anything. They live their lives and they really are absolutely amazing people. So just wanted to mention that, because I would like people to think about it a little bit. And there are hundreds of millions of people with visual impairments worldwide. So different levels of visual impairment. Not everyone has legal level of blindness, but this is likely going to be a problem which is going to be even bigger in the future. So lots of possible cases of people who might need some assistance.
Okay, so if you had to summarize what people should take from this episode in one or two sentences, what would you say were the most important things?
I would say that people, like, if you listen to this podcast, think about how much information you receive visually in your life, and imagine how it would be like to live without that information, first of all. And also, I would say that our capacity to process tactile signals is amazing, and we don't really use it in our lives that much, because our skin and our ability to receive tactile information is enormous, and I think it's gonna be a big deal in the next couple of years, not only in assistive devices, but I think also in lots of other cases, possibly some, I don't know, VR gaming or some entertainment areas might use that in the future. So some food for thought, because I think it's really, really interesting stuff that I learned.
And which role would you say does cognition play in your research?
Well, so cognition is a big term. So we are dealing with, like, more general cognition than visual cognition, which is frequently being studied. So I think our research is based within a framework of studying sensory augmentation, maybe a little bit. So ability of people to use some more sensory signals that they are used to usually. I don't think we are doing anything of sensory substitution nature, but I think within, like, broader cognition label, I would locate our research in a brain plasticity as well. So how people are able to use devices of different capacities. But as I said, it's kind of tricky with the braceset. It's not as it's different type of device compared to the belt, which is more easily it's more easy to put belt under some label of kind of research or line of research. With bracelets, we can focus on people's ability to process tactile signals, but also it's very task focused, so it's a little bit more real life device than general science device, I would say. We can learn a lot of scientific stuff developing that along the way, but it's also more related to real life scenarios, which is also what I liked about this project when I was doing the interviews and recruitment, because I also did some, like, basic science in Poland back in the days, some fundamental science, and I liked it, but I also felt that, yeah, I do some research, we have some results, and it doesn't change a thing in the world. It just adds to this, like, conceptual scientific knowledge that we have as humans. And here I can really feel or see that potentially we can help some people, and it's really cool.
That being said, thank you so much for talking to us and explaining your project to us. It was really interesting to hear how vibration and the whole technique around it gets investigated more to help people. And I really hope that it will find some real life application in the future, because I think it can be really handy for a lot of people. So thank you very much for taking your time and being here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And once again, for our listeners, we will link both episodes we previously had on the topic in the show notes. If you want to listen up on the episode that was mentioned a couple of times with Suzanne on the space belt, but also the one with Piper on the first steps of the bracelet, we will link both of them in our show notes. You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Leslie Volk, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Luca Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.